Now, a group of theologians were discussing predestination and free will. When the argument became heated, the dissidents split into two groups. One man, unable to make up his mind which group to join, slipped into the predestination crowd. Challenged as to why he was there, he said, "Hey, I came here of my own free will." The group reported, "Free will? You can't join us." He retreated to the opposite group and met the same challenge. "I was sent here," he said honestly, "Get out," they stormed. "You can't join us unless we come of your own free will." "Which is right. Now, I heard of a man who stumbled and fell down the steps of a large church. One Arminian, who considered free will to be predominant, watched and said, 'I wonder why he did that. I wonder how that happened.' A Calvinist watched and said, 'I bet he's glad that it's over.'" What God's will would. Anyways, okay, let's get right on to it. Anyways, maybe that wasn't as funny as... I was thinking that maybe a theologian has to understand that joke. But anyways, the issue of God's sovereignty versus free will has confronted and even divided the Church of Jesus Christ for centuries. The debate exists because there are verses that indicate the validity of one, while others verses indicate the validity of the other. Now, for anyone who has been around me for any length of time, I look at that and say, why can't it be a both and rather than an either or? Just because we can't rationalize how the two exist together doesn't mean it doesn't work in God's economy. So we believe and learn what is valuable about God's sovereignty. We believe and learn what is valuable about free will, what we internalize about it, and then let God worry about how they fit together. Now, this issue comes up because the next verse we cover in Matthew 11, verse 25, emphasizes the sovereignty of God operating in salvation, or does it? Let's turn and let's see. Now, remember that Jesus, in John 11, has been encouraging John the Baptist, reinforcing his value in God's plan of redemption. That led Jesus to talk about the rejection of John and Jesus as well. This then causes Jesus to say what he does in verse 25 and 26 of Matthew 11, or at least where Matthew places these statements in terms of being consistent with what Jesus would say in relation to, again, what he has said about the rejection, particularly of these Galilean cities, of the miracles, remember, that he had performed there, and how they were culpable because of the fact that they saw those things and did not accept Jesus in the way that Jesus would require or think would be validating his miracles. So ultimately, verse 25 and 26 of Matthew 11, it says, "At that time, Jesus said, 'I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure.'" Now, I like what the word commentary says about these verses. It says, confronted by the resistance and unbelief, Jesus can yet praise the Father, for his will is being worked out both in those who receive and in those who reject the gospel. I mean, ultimately, God is glorified either because of us or in spite of us. Because of the fact that his salvation is free and open to anyone, if we reject that, we still validate God's glory in terms of the fact that he offers it to people even who would reject it. Now, the decision that we have to make here in terms of these verses, though, is do these verses say something about God? Do they say something about us? Or do they say something about the both of us? See, because some look here and they see the sovereignty of God and his elective purposes. I think you see it too. It's pretty evident here. I mean, it is talking about God revealing certain things to certain people and not revealing things to other people. The fact that Jesus, even in this context, talks about God's good pleasure. And it was, again, it's his will. It's his desire to do what he has done. Certainly reminds us of the fact that ultimately God can do whatever he wants. Let me say that again. That God can do whatever he wants. I mean, ultimately, the best place we can ever be is to understand and ultimately appreciate the fact that God can do whatever he wants. In fact, in a series that I do on the character of God, the section that deals with the sovereignty of God, the byline for that is God's sovereignty, comfort, or control. And when we internalize God's sovereignty, do we think about that controlling us? Or rather, do we find the comfort that exists? And I'll go into that a little more in just a little bit. I mean, the only thing that God can't do is he can't act in a way inconsistent with his will. I mean, his will and his character, rather. That God can't be who he is not, but will always be who he is and will fulfill his purposes regardless of what we do. Now, others, though, look at this passage and clearly see the culpability and free will of man. Both in the verses preceding, where again, Jesus was talking about these Galilean cities, where he had done these miracles, and remember, if those miracles had been done in Sodom, you know, they would have believed, they were done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have believed, but these Galilean cities, these Jewish cities, saw the Son of God in action, saw him doing the things that the Messiah was called to do, and was prophesied to do, and yet they rejected him. So clearly there was free will there that Jesus is pointing to. And even here, there's an element of the kind of people that God reveals to, right? In other words, there's the aspect of, are you self-sufficient? Are you the wise and learned? Or are you childlike? And don't you have an input? Don't you decide what kind of person that you are? And this is where I say, why not both and rather than either or? See, I take great comfort in the idea that God is sovereign, that he's in control. Particularly when we find the world going out of control, particularly when we see evil having its day, where we see bad things happening and the progress of things of people that are against God or opposed to the things of God. To know that God is still in control, to know that God is still trying to work his good purposes and good pleasure. See, I like the idea that God is doing what he wants. Because I understand who God is. I understand that God is a loving, powerful, just, merciful, and righteous God. That God is always going to do what's perfect. I mean, and don't we recognize that ultimately that's what we want? Like, we don't even necessarily want what's comfortable or nice or pretty. We want what's right. We want what's perfect. And so even if the suffering we have is part of a perfect plan of God to accomplish what he knows to be right, again, isn't that a comfort to us? Even in the midst of bad things, to know that a God is working for good, trying to accomplish his purposes. And then on the other hand, don't I want to be childlike? And whatever Jesus would be communicating in terms of the kind of people that God reveals to little children, don't I want to be childlike? Don't I want to be humble? Don't I want to be teachable? Don't I want to be dependent on him? I mean, if what God doesn't reveal to are the self-sufficient, are the learned and the wise who say, hey, you know, I've got this God. Don't I want to be different than that? Don't I want to be the kind of person that God would reveal things to, that can accept the things that God is doing? And so again, I see the aspects of, again, both the sovereignty of God and the free will of man operating here. And again, I see a both and rather than an either or. But I actually think these verses say something else as well, and maybe even something more important than all that. And that is that God is the kind of God that if he comes to you and you say, hey, I'm all set, I've got this figured out, if you're the kind of person that says, you know something, I am wise and learned and I don't need you, God, you know what God will say is, fine, you're on your own. I won't bother you anymore, kind of. I mean, I think God is relentlessly pursuing us. Like, even if we say, God, I've got this, I don't want you anymore, he's still going to find ways and avenues to get into our lives and reveal himself. But ultimately, if you want to act in pride and independence, God will allow you to do that. See, that's the kind of God that he is. But on the other hand, if you are childlike, if you are dependent, teachable, trusting, then it is to those he reveals himself and makes himself available. And say, because he is that kind of God, and don't miss this, because he is that kind of God, doesn't it make sense if his election is based on that? In other words, I think that's more what Jesus is saying, about that God is the kind of God that reveals things to the childlike person. So in his elective purpose, what his good pleasure was to reveal it to those people that would then accept it. And so ultimately, more than Jesus talking about who he's choosing and not choosing, He's talking about the kind of people that, or the kind of God that God is, and the kind of people that are able to receive what God is accomplishing. So really, the fact that this childlikeness, in a positive way, you know, revealed to them to little children, it's said in a positive way in verse 25 here, but if you remember in verse 16, it was kind of said in a negative way. You know, they're like children sitting in the marketplace calling out to others and so on and so forth. And so what I challenged you last week with is the idea of, are we going to be childlike or we're going to be childish? Because I think we know what that means, right? We understand what maybe we're even willing to admit how childish we can be. Have you ever done that to yourself? Like maybe seeing yourself in your self-sufficiency or your pride or maybe your self-centeredness or maybe in that tendency of thinking the world kind of revolves around you. That maybe there's this expectation that people and God kind of owe you something. That you desire to be the center of attention. And that if people aren't recognizing you or paying attention to you or giving you highs or thank yous or whatever, then now you're going to be upset. Or maybe being easily offended. I know sometimes when I'm easily offended and I get very bitter towards people, I look at myself and say, you're being childish. Well, like, who do you think you are to think that they should have treated you in a certain way? And so ultimately, I think we understand the dynamics of us, even in terms of our adulthood, how childish we can become. See, ultimately, the hardest lesson for us to learn, that it is not about us, it's about God and others. Always remind yourself of that. It's not about you, it's about God, and it's about other people. But then to be childlike, in the sense of trusting, innocent, teachable, pure, loving, that you recognize that God is your hero. And there's nothing anyone else can say to change that. Remember those days? Remember those days when you were your child's hero? You know, some of you are still there. Appreciate those days. When like people come to the door and they're excited to see you. You know, I don't have that anymore. That's why I have dogs. Because at least someone is excited to see. See, everyone recognizes. Well, my wife recognizes it's good that I'm home, but she's not running up to me like my kids did. You know, daddy's home, because I was my children's hero. See, now it's right that our children move on from there in terms of their lives, that to recognize that I'm not their hero. Like, I'm probably not as good as they thought I was when they were children, and I'm certainly not as bad as they think that I am as their teenagers. We know that too, right? But there's a point for us to never lose that with God. Never lose that, just that childish admiration of God. Like, God, that there's just a simplicity of what I have towards you in terms of my relationship and my appreciation for you. Like, are we willing to be childlike? That's what Jesus is pointing us to. See, and again, if we focus on, well, you know something, it's just the elective purpose of God, and you're either that or this, and it doesn't really matter, what fun is that? When we can't do something about it, but when we see Jesus, this is the kind of people God reveals to, well, don't you say like I say? Well, I want to be childlike then. If God reveals to people that are childlike, well, whether you've chosen me or not, God, I'm going to be childlike. Now, if that reflects your elective purpose, fine. But in terms of my will and what I'm experiencing on this earth, I know full well that I have a choice, that I have a decision to make. Because I know I can be childlike or I can be childish, and I have to decide in some ways every moment of every day what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to make it about me or about God, His will or my will. And so again, there's just an aspect of us seeing what Jesus is saying here, calling us to be that kind of person. Now as we move on in the text, so just some other very important verses here in terms of what we see in verses 25 through 30 here. But so moving on in terms of what Jesus says here. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal Him. You know, in some ways it's important for us to put markers in the Bible. It's not like Jesus doesn't say this infrequently, but the times that Jesus, in an unqualified way, shows us that He knows who He is. You know, there are some people who say that, you know something, Jesus never thought He was the Son of God. Jesus really never thought He was the Messiah. That was people after Him coming along and saying, this is who Jesus was. But now to hear Jesus saying unqualified things about what He understands Him to be, Himself to be. I mean, Jesus knows who God is. Like, He knows what is entailed in all. I mean, look at verse 27. All things have been committed to me by my Father. Do you know how brash a statement that is? How bold a statement that is? Would any of us ever say that all things have been committed to me by God in heaven? What? Me? I would say this much. Like, you have all things and you have this much. This is what's been committed to me. But in the context, we could say, like, the all things is talking about revelation. You know, Jesus is going to move from God choosing who He's going to reveal to now who He's choosing to reveal Himself to. But I think it goes beyond that. It's part of the context, certainly, but I think Jesus is saying something greater. That all things have been committed to me, have been entrusted to me, have been granted to me, is what Jesus is saying. So he's unqualified in terms of, again, how clear His awareness is of who He is. Second thing to notice here is notice the deep and intimate connection between the Father and the Son. I mean, no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son. You know, in some ways we know that this isn't true. We can know the Father through the Son. We can know Jesus. But what Jesus is saying, compared to my relationship with God, it's like no one knows us. Like, there's just a oneness, there's a connection that happens between the members of the Trinity that no one can fathom, no one can understand. And Jesus is pointing us to understand again what He realizes about His relationship with the Father. In fact, to say more than that, to try and define what Jesus is saying, we really can't. We just have to accept by faith that Jesus is that close to God, and God is that close to Him. But then beyond that, the third thing to notice is that in much the same way that the Father is choosing to reveal Himself to certain people in verse 25 and 26, the Son is both a conduit to that revelation and also is choosing as well, as we see, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal Him. So whatever you would see in terms of sovereignty here, whatever you would see in terms of election here, Jesus is joining the Father in terms of that responsibility. But, like so many times, right after you see this aspect of what might emphasize sovereignty, you now have the free will aspect. What does He say in verse 28? After saying all that about the I choose to reveal, so on and so forth, what does He say? Come! He says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I mean, the first thing to recognize in this verse is that Jesus' offer is to everyone. He's saying, anyone who would choose, everyone who would take me up on the offer, you come. Again, the unabashed, unconditional nature of the offer of God. And so therefore, this is not the restrictive thing we would find in terms of God choosing someone or not choosing someone, because we have a choice. We have a choice whether or not we'll come. But then beyond that, I hope that you are just comforted by these verses. I hope that you are drawn in by these verses. I hope that you are convicted by these verses. But to see first and foremost, in terms of what Jesus is saying, come all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. I mean, who of us are weary and burdened today? I mean, who of us say, you know something, I really can't handle this. I really don't have it all together. See, Jesus, again, doesn't have to say this. He could say, come to me, all the proud and well-off, and the people have got it all together. Those are the people I want. I mean, I see Jesus here almost like the Statue of Liberty. Give me your huddled masses and your poor and your lame and, you know, come to America for the land of opportunity. But Jesus is even greater than that in terms of just saying, you know something, when you recognize your brokenness, when you have brokenness, you're exactly the people that God wants you to be. And so he says, come. And so therefore, if you feel like you're rejected, if you feel like you're missing something, if you feel like there's gaps in your life, if you feel like there's things you can't handle and you can't overcome, Jesus says, come. If you're burdened, if you're weary, if you're challenged, if you're tired, come and I will give you rest. I mean, rest is nice, right? After a hard day's work or whatever, just to sit down and rest and release yourself. Like, I'm not going to stress about this. I'm not going to work at this. I'm not going to worry about this. That, to me, is rest. But I'm not sure if anyone else is struck by the idea of what Jesus says next. That he talks about rest there in 28. He talks about rest in 29. But then he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your soul. So in some ways, he's kind of defining what that rest is about in verse 28. But is anyone else struck by the idea that a yoke would be attached to rest? I mean, yoke is a work thing. Yoke is a thing you put on the oxen to, like, have them work together and till the field. Yoke is not a rest thing. You know, when you're on the couch, you don't put a yoke on you, right? You don't say, okay, let me get that yoke and let me sit down. No, if you've got a yoke on, you're out in the field and you're working. So what is Jesus saying? How can a yoke be connected to his work? I mean, connected to his rest, rather. We can understand how it was connected to his work. But how is it connected to rest? I think the first thing to me is when Jesus talks about my yoke, I start thinking about other yokes. I think about other yokes that are upon us. When I think about sin, I think about addiction, I think about legalism. I think a primary thing that Jesus is addressing here is the legalistic laws of the Pharisees. The fact that the Jewish people thought, I've got to do all these things right, I've got to dot my I's, I've got to cross my T's, I've got to make sure I obey this law, I have to make sure I do this thing and that thing, clean myself here, sacrifice that there, do to the priest here, but all these different things. So in some ways, Jesus is saying, take my yoke upon you, the yoke of grace, the yoke of righteousness that I offer you, not a righteousness that you're trying to attain for yourself. But I think there are other yokes as well. Yokes of people's opinion. People who walk around worried about what people are thinking. Worried about this or that in terms of being in the right standing with different people. That's a tremendous yoke to bear. A yoke of fear. Being afraid of things, always being concerned about this or that, to taking into account all the things that could happen to you and everyone else you're related to. Do you know people like that? I know people like that. That they sit home and they're worried about, not only about themselves and what could happen to them, but then their children, then their grandchildren. It's like, don't get to know any more people, please. Because every time you get to know a person, now you're worried and afraid about what's going to happen to them. That's a tremendous yoke to bear. How about the yoke of materialism? The yoke of, again, keeping up with the Joneses. The yoke of, again, having the things that are commensurate either with comfort or recognition in terms of this world. You know, just think about the yokes that you put on yourself. Think about the yokes I put on myself that, again, that burden us, that are hard to carry, that are difficult to manage, things that bring us down rather than things that lift us up. So I think in some ways, Jesus talks about a yoke, his yoke, because he wants us to think about other yokes that could be upon us. But I think the other thing that Jesus is just being honest about, that there is an aspect of our walk with him that is about a yoke, that is about work. I mean, we think about, if I asked you, if you could absolutely know the will of God, would you do it? I think all of us would say, yes. If I knew, if God was standing here, if I stood before God, and God every moment of every day said, okay, do this, now do this, now do this, now do this, we would be able to buy into that system readily. But you know something? God has chosen not to make it that easy. See, if we are going to do the will of God, the first thing we need to do is know the will of God. And before we know the will of God, I believe we have to know God. See, when I see the mixture of what is happening in this verse in terms of, again, God talking about in 25 through 27, His elective purposes, the things that He's decided, the things that He has planned, and then talks to me about coming to Him and learning of Him and submitting myself to Him, being childlike before Him, I think about knowing that will. I think about the kind of things that are part of that will. I think about Romans 12:2. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. So see, for us to know the will of God, for us to do the will of God, we have to have our minds renewed. And you know something? I believe that's a primary place that the work is. I think that's a primary place where the yoke has to be taken on. Well, we have to understand that there's a lot of garbage up here. There's a lot of wrong thinking up here. There's a lot of corruption up here. Think about all the things that you expose yourself to in the world that if they're not contrary, directly contrary to God, certainly are not pointing you to Him. I mean, think about the things in the world that you read, that you watch, that you listen to, whatever, that aren't actively pointing to God. And now, think about that and compare to how much input you have that positively promotes God in your life. Time in the Word, worship, listening to Christian things rather than secular things. You know, you have to think about, again, if we are going to, again, learn of Christ, if we're going to take the yoke that He's talking about here, following the will of God, are we willing to have our minds renewed? Are we willing to, again, subject ourselves to the Word of God? To take the discipline? Like when you're going to read the Word, when you're deciding to come to church, when you're deciding to do things that you know God would have you to do, and that's hard, like you feel like, okay, this isn't just coming natural. I have to, like, you know, maybe arrange my schedule or not do this or sacrifice this to do this. I'm just tired and I don't want... That's the yoke. See, voila, the yoke. See, the minute you find it hard to do the will of God, okay, remember what Jesus said, my yoke is easy. Yeah, He's going to give me rest. Like part of this deal, like I take His yoke on me and the result is rest. But you know something? That doesn't mean the rest comes without work. That there's an effort to transform our minds. There's an effort to transform our lives. There's a discipline that says, I'm going to be in the Word on a daily basis. It's a discipline to say, I'm going to pray on a daily basis. I'm going to develop my relationship with God, where nothing in the world is telling you to do that. Again, it's not necessarily opposed. It's not like everything you listen to is saying, I hate God, don't believe. But it's certainly not drawing you to that. It's just saying, be independent. Just do your, have it your way. Aren't you worth it? You deserve this. You know, and again, it's all easy. It's all compromise. It's all material. It's all about flesh. But God is saying, let me show you the Spirit. Let me show you what I have in terms of my work in your life. Because I think that's another part of it. See, when we take the yoke upon Him, when we take His yoke upon us, and we renew our minds, we're obedient, I think that's another part of His yoke, then the result is going to be rest for our souls. See, because that rest comes from the idea that when I connect to the spiritual disciplines, when I connect to the disciplines of the Christian life, prayer, studying the Word, being in the fellowship of believers, being in church, giving, whatever it might be in terms of, again, part of that yoke,
We just had to realize that God is undergirding that. God is strengthening that. God is enabling that. God is equipping that. And so therefore, are we willing to take that yoke upon us? Are we willing to take on us a yoke that is easy, a burden that is light, that again, will still represent sacrifice in our lives, but again, will ultimately to bring us to a place of resolution, a place of comfort, a place of peace, a place of solitude in terms of all that God desires for us. You know, ultimately, we have to see in this a challenge and support. To know His will, to follow His will, takes work. But God is supporting us in that. God is undergirding us with His strength, again, to bring that rest. You mean for us to experience the peace, the relaxation that God intends for us to have. You know, I'm going to actually ask the worship team to come forward and to sing that song, that or have us sing that song that we ended our worship with this morning. Because when I look at that song where it talks about us laying down our pride, laying down our dreams, see, to me that's come. That's come if you're weary, come if you're burdened, and surrender yourself to Him. So let's bow and let's pray as they come up. Father, we just do thank You for the offer You make, for the willingness that You have to take broken people and make us whole, that You give us the capacity to be childlike before You rather than childish in our flesh. And so, Father, I just pray that when it comes to those things that are part of Your yoke, that we would accept those, that we would internalize those, that would ultimately seek to be the people that You desire for us to be. And that really does start with us surrendering ourselves to You and laying our burdens down before You. It's in Your Son's name that I pray. Amen.